friends and enemies, welcome to Bad Voltage Season 3, Episode 51, which I confess I had to go and look up because I wasn't on the last one. So, did you do some kind of special celebration for show 50,
Jono?
So then we'll go, 51 is exciting because it's, I don't know, 3 17s or something.
Anyway. Some kind of mathematical, yeah. No, we didn't do anything special other than appreciating you, Mr. Stuart Langridge. That's all we did.
I'll believe you,
yeah,
despite the fact that I'm inclined not to. So, I'm Stuart Langridge. I'm here with John O'Bacon, no middle name, and Jeremy's not currently here because he's running, attending, managing huge Datadog conference dash. So instead, we have a special guest presenter. Yes, we do.
Yeah, we do. Adam Larimer, welcome to the show, Adam.
Oh, thank you very much. I feel honoured and humbled to be here.
Yeah, you should be.
I don't think that will last, though.
I have heard a lot about the Bad Voltage podcast. I have to admit, I've never actually listened to one. But I've heard
you and everyone else
talk about it.
Yeah, so for those of you who don't know, which is basically everybody, Adam and I used to be neighbors. When my wife and I moved to Walnut Creek, I was thrilled to get away from English people, and then he came plumping over. I was like, "Hi, nice to meet you. Just wanted to introduce ourselves." Like, fucking English people next to me.
I was there first. I have to say, we were there first. You could have done your research.
Yes, that would be creepy.
I feel I should point out that we're not just looking for guest presenters among the list of people who Jono have lived next door to. At least partially because I remember the people in Wolverhampton and they're not coming on the show. So
extending your breath out to like next door but one.
right.
No. Well, we have a topic and we wanted to pull in someone with some expertise on the topic, and so we decided to talk to Adam.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about Meta, the obviously rebranded Facebook. They recently had their Meta Connect event where they were talking through all the stuff that they're doing to work in the metaverse. And Adam Larimer here is quite the expert when it comes to VR. Do you want to give us a quick 1 minute background around what you do, Adam?
Yeah. So I do a number of things, but the relevant thing to hear is I am head of North America for Glue Collaboration, which is an immersive collaboration platform, primarily for companies, for enterprise. We do a little bit in the educational sector as well, but mostly it's about recreating that sense of being in the same room with your team or your customers or your clients. And you know, having that, there's something about being in a room with someone that's different from a video call. Although it's fun being on a video call with you guys, of course. there's something, and we take an essence of that, and we transfer that in an immersive virtual reality platform.
And it's all VR, right? It's not AR. It's not mixed reality. It's all VR. Is that right?
It is not AR for the time being. We do support desktop platforms. You don't need a headset to use Glue. I think it's a lot better with a headset, which we can delve into. But for the time being, not augmented reality. And we can talk about the differences and the distinctions of those if it's relevant.
Right.
Well, this will be interesting. So, at least partially, I can foresee two things happening on this show. First of all, given your interest in the sort of enterprise-y, people sharing meetings and so on in VR, you probably thought MetaConnect was really cool. And we'll get into some of what that's about. And secondly, you and me are going to have a row at some point during this show.
this is going to happen, which is the reason.
Don't take it too personally. I might have strong opinions, but they're loosely held. So I'm ready to be educated.
Langridge has strong opinions, strongly held. So
you're not wrong. But yeah, so, it would be useful to talk a bit about what actually happened at MetaConnect. And Jono, always ready to credulously embrace anything about VR. Presumably, you paid quite a lot of attention to all the different things that happened. So, do you want to summarize?
Why don't I spin through it? Yeah.
Some of what they talked about. And Do I have to shut up until the end, or are we discussing each point as we get
Why don't we do this? Why don't I break it into a few pieces? Well, first of all, talk about the new headset that they're releasing called the MetaQuest Pro. Then we'll talk a little bit about maybe mixed reality, and then we'll talk a bit about some of the other bits and pieces. Like, they showed off their next gen avatars. They talked about Microsoft Teams partnership, which is
yeah.
And then we might want to spend a little bit of time. It's a bit not quite related to this, with their motor neuron control thing that they've been building, which is kind of interesting, but very early.
I got to think about that when we get there.
Yeah. All right. So why don't I first of all summarize the headset, yes. And I'm sure that path that we've plotted, we will certainly not stay to, right? But let me summarize it. So first of all, as listeners will be familiar, Meta have got various headsets. Their Quest 2 is the most recent headset, which is pretty popular. It's all in one. It's not like connected to a computer. You can actually connect it with a cable, and it's actually been doing reasonably well. The Meta Quest Pro. Well, the MetaQuest, the Quest 2, you can pick up for about $300, I think it is. The MetaQuest Pro is going to be $1,500. And it's very clearly intended towards much more of a commercial audience. The kind of people who, I imagine, Adam is very interested in working at Glue. It's a much more advanced headset. It was known as Project Cambria, which we talked about previously in the show.
We did.
I'm going to summarize a couple of the elements of it. I'm going to be missing some of this stuff out. But basically, it's a much sleeker headset. It doesn't look like a shoebox glued to the front of your head. It's got these pancake lenses. The resolution of these lenses seems to be, and of the video that you're seeing through the lenses seems to be much higher. It's actually a heavier headset, but what they've done is they've equalized the weight. So the battery's on the back. It's actually a curved battery. And then the screen's on the front because it's light. It basically equalizes, so it doesn't feel like it's just tipping your head forward, from what I've read. And what's interesting is that with the Quest 2, it was all about VR, right? They do have a pass-through mode, which is where you can see the world through it, but it's like looking at, you know, it looks like it's rendered in CGA from 1994, yes. Right? And it's really just used primarily to draw the Guardian so you don't bang into your dog while you're playing it. Or in Horizon Workrooms, which is where people can work together, they use it to so you can actually see your keyboard when you're setting that up as well, from what I understand. I've actually never used Horizon Workrooms. Well, that's what I read. But what's interesting is that it actually, by default, doesn't block out all the light because, and I'll get to this in a second, a big focus of the MetaQuest Pro is on mixed reality. And with mixed reality, you don't necessarily want all the light blocked out, because one of the things that people complain about with VR is that you're kind of trapped inside it and it's a little bit overwhelming. So what they've got is you can actually see the light through the bottom of the headset, and then they've got these magnetic clip-on light blockers that go on the bottom of it. So if you want it to be a bit more immersive, you can do that as well. And they've got some extra thing that you can buy for $50, which, you know, blocks out even more of it.
I was going to say, yeah, we should note that the magnetic clip-on things cost extra money.
I think the clip-ons come with it, but the other thing... It costs money, I think.
You get a partial one in the box, and then if you want something which blocks out the light, so it becomes a VR headset, you got to pay extra for it, yes.
Specs-wise, it looks kind of interesting. It's what you'd expect, you know, a big step up. The key things that that really stand out from what I can tell as well is that it's got built-in face detection and eye tracking. And one of the things that they demoed was, you know, when you are in VR, you've got these kind of very cartoony looking, lifeless looking avatars. And Adam and I have actually chatted about this for years at this point, is that so much of you need to be able to see the expressions, but it doesn't necessarily have to be photorealistic. So the face detection and the eye tracking, also the eye tracking enables what people call foveated rendering, which they haven't actually switched on, which is where it renders in high quality what you're looking at, and then kind of the periphery of your vision, it doesn't render to a high enough to the same kind of quality. That's not actually switched on in the MetaQuest Pro, and the reason why is because it's incredibly performance intensive and it'll drain the battery. But also the controllers, and everybody might have seen these, the controllers that come with the Quest 2, they've got these like rings around them. Well, with the new controllers, they've got haptics built in, similar in some ways to the PlayStation 5. I don't think they've got adaptive triggers, but they also do full 360 range. So you can actually put them behind your back. And if this is not enabled right now, but the idea is that the cameras in them will also scan your legs. So they will have legs.
We'll get to legs.
But we will get to that because there's been some controversy around that. But just to finish off, the real focus of it was really around this mixed reality. Now, some of you on the show may have heard of VR, of course, which is where you're in this completely virtual world. AR is where essentially holograms are overlaid over actual glasses. So the Magic Leap is like that. Mixed reality is where you're looking at a screen right next to your eyes, but the real world is in there, and it's not just a video feed. What they actually do is they map out the world and they actually overlay the video feed on the meshed detected surfaces that you're seeing, because otherwise it wouldn't work effectively. John Carmack has got a really interesting talk about this. It's on YouTube. And they were showing, for example, you could sit there in your office having a meeting with somebody and their cartoony figure is opposite you. But you're in your actual world, and the idea is that it feels real. Now, from what people have said, it doesn't feel completely real. You still feel like you're seeing a video feed of your world, but it's much, much better than anything else that's out there right now. So I'll stop there. Thoughts?
Okay, so a few thoughts. First of all, the battery loss, an hour.
An hour?
Yeah.
You sure about that?
They say 1 to 2 hours. And I would like you to think back to literally every piece of consumer electronics you've ever bought and how long the batteries last by comparison with how long the manufacturer said it would last. And that's on day one. Right?
Really?
Yeah. This is the controller battery, 4 to 5 hours. But the headset, 1, maybe 2 hours.
That's absurd.
Yes, it is. I mean, and so we can get into the whole jam tomorrow nature of all VR technology since the beginning of VR technology.
Now, hang on, before you go on, because you have a tendency.
I wasn't going to.
You have a tendency to shit on everything that's new. Why don't we mix this up a little bit? Tell us what you think is interesting and cool about it briefly, and then tell us what you.
Okay.
Cause I wanna, yeah.
Huh. So. Man,
I just dumped him. Now.
I mean, honestly, I have both systemic and individual complaints. Most of the things that I would say I think are cool are things that I'm not actually that bothered about. So I think a lot of the technology in this thing is pretty cool. So you've got the actual display resolution is not a lot better than the Quest 2, but it's one screen per eye. Right, which is a nice start. I don't understand the difference between Fresnel and pancake lenses, despite having now done a bunch of reading about the difference between the two, but whatever.
It's kind of irrelevant as well, isn't it? I mean, what about what about the sense of presence or like what it's going to do for you beyond the tech?
Well, this is the... I was trying to avoid launching into my complaint about the whole thing early, but sure, if you're asking the question, and this is, I'm going to be interested in Adam's point of view about exactly this, is I don't know anyone who actually wants to sit in a 90s CGI version of their room and look at the 90s CGI version of their workmates.
Well, the Quest Pro is not 90 CGI. It's SVGA.
it's still a Memoji that I'm looking at. The fact that it can, mocap. It's like playing L.A. Noir. Right?
What do you think, Adam?
Okay, so one of the things that I find myself saying a lot is that. Talking about virtual reality is a lot of like dancing about architecture. They're both communication mediums, but it's really hard to describe one with the other. So, I don't know how much time you've spent in multi-user virtual reality experiences.
Multi-user, not that much. I've tried a couple of things, but I confess not for very long. And I have not tried... Has anyone tried, apart from John Carmack, has anyone actually tried the the pro stuff yet, or is it not actually available?
We've got one in our office in Helsinki. We've had one for a while. We have got the developer versions because we're launching a build for it. So there's a lot of stuff that's counterintuitive that you wouldn't expect. And if you play a lot of video games and if you're looking at it as a gaming experience, you know, it's not up to the fidelity of a AAA video game, right? VR doesn't do that in terms of character animation and that whole kind of visual fidelity thing. So it depends on what you want, right? If you're looking for a AAA video game experience, I don't think VR is there yet. If you want a feeling of being somewhere else and being somewhere else with other people, then visual fidelity is surprisingly unimportant. Things like spatialized audio are much more important. Things like having some form of real compelling like facial movement makes a lot more difference than it does having the quality and the resolution of the CGI. In fact, there's a phenomenon called the Uncanny Valley, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with. It comes from robotics in the 70s, where if you try to make something too realistic, particularly photorealistic, it's unnerving. You can see it in computer animation in movies. You look at something like Rogue One, the Star Wars movie. That was state of the art. You're bringing back Peter Cushing and Carrie Fisher for that movie. That was state of the art. That took months of work to get there, and supercomputers running for months to get that those little clips of work. And it still was it's still creepy. If you put that into what can be done with essentially what is a cell phone strapped to your face and done 90 times per second, we're nowhere near that. So what you actually want to do is dial down the visual fidelity to something that captures the essence of how you communicate and what makes a face or a person compelling in order to do that and then simplify it as much as possible. And it works. Yep. And that goes into legs as well.
And that's that last little bit you dropped on there, and it works, is, I think, to me, the important point. Because the idea that, we can't do photorealistic stuff, fine, I get that, you know, and I'm not asking for that because it's completely unrealistic. Even in films, which are a combination of visual effects and pure computer-generated imagery, there is still the Uncanny Valley effect. There is still that in top-tier AAA games now, and I'm not particularly looking for that. Sure, if a duck flies in the window and gives me a completely photorealistic, I can't tell the difference between the world and it VR headset, cool. I'll probably use that one, but I'm not worried about that. What my issue is the issue, there seems to be a pitch of, we can't do that, but we can do basically like watching The Incredibles. Which is, you know, sure, if that's what you want. And at no point do I watch cartoons and go, but this is unrealistic, and so I can't engage with the story.
That's a very important point. A lot of time they're more compelling. A stylized face.
But, and this is the point, the first question in there is, why would I want this at all? Has been skipped over. The assumption is, what people want is to sit in a computer-generated version of their office and talk to computer-generated versions of their teammates or whatever. And therefore, the best we can do is that it looks like Toy Story 4. Yep. So let's make it so that's as realistic, not realistic, that's as expressive as possible. But no one wants this.
Let me address that within the very narrow niche of what I do every day.
Which is why I said I think it'd be interesting to have you talking about this.
We could talk about consumer applications of the metaverse and various other things, which I think are down the line. The reason why I work in enterprise rather than in anything else associated, I've been doing this for long enough that the metaverse wasn't a thing when I started. It was a thing. It was science fiction, which it still is. We had over the last few years the biggest unplanned experiment in remote work that the world has ever seen. And a lot of people were shoved into changing the way they interact with their colleagues and doing it over video call as their primary source of of collaboration and of communication with their colleagues. You know, people are starting to come back to the office, but we've still, you know, we've not regained the status quo that we were at before the pandemic. And for me, at least, one-on-one video works pretty well. You know, you can feel connected and engaged with someone one-on-one. Three people in a room, yeah, maybe a little bit right now. Right now, I've got a, you know, a big picture of Jono and a little picture of Stuart. I don't really feel
just like my house. Together.
Just well, you know, Jono always likes to grab the limelight in any situation.
He does though. But,
this is unnecessary. Talk about go back to VR.
Okay, sorry, VR. I'm just so used to making fun of you, Jono.
I know.
What were we talking about? So, but if you get more than four people, I get lost. Like, it is like talking to a Brady Bunch of squares on your screen. There's no sense of actually being there. You can't kind of direct your comments to one person. You end up in this paradigm where you have to like have, okay, it's my turn to talk. Everyone else listens. Next person's turn to talk. They talk. Everyone else listens. Otherwise, it's chaos, and people are always talking over each other.
And even worse when you're online and you're dialing into a conference room, where people are physically in the same room. That's the worst scenario to be connecting with people.
Any kind of asymmetric communication is horrible. It just doesn't work. You might as well get the minutes of the meeting after the meeting because you're not really there. But even if you're all on video and you're all there and everyone has actually turned their camera on and people are actually paying attention rather than spending the, you know, doing emails while listening out for their name or their voice. And when someone asks them a question, like, oh yeah, just repeat the question. Make sure that I fully understand what you're saying because you weren't listening. We've all been there on video calls. But even if people are fully engaged, it's still like you're talking into the void, right? You're talking into a black hole. There's no actual sense of being there. You can't kind of turn and address your comments to one person. You can't quickly have more than one conversation going on at once in the room, like you do in a real room. In a real room, people are kind of talking over each other. They're, you know, using their body language to say, okay, I know I want to project a point. They're having, you know, maybe two conversations going on at once, and then it comes back together again. It's much more dynamic. And by adding in a third dimension, you really can do that in a much more compelling way. And, you know, you can bring in 3D models, and you can grab sticky notes and stick them on a whiteboard and argue over the sticky note and pull it down and rearrange it in a very kind of organic way. You know, it's not as abstracted as some of these kind of interactive whiteboards use, which they're good too. But it's kind of abstracted. It's not like you're grabbing something, you're passing it to someone. You know, you can't shake hands with someone. You can't look at someone in the eye when you're talking to them. And that
to me is, you know, it's interesting because with Adam working at Glue, we've talked a lot in the past about like VR and work and things like that. And often when we've been chatting about some of this stuff, it's been those methods of collaborating that you can't really do as easily on other platforms like Zoom or whatever. The thing that really, I was kind of just watching along with the metaverse and not particularly excited about it, but curious about it. I have to say, when I watched Meta Connect, the thing that I started getting really excited, and I've been just kind of going through YouTube videos, learning more and more about this, is that sense of presence. Is that, you know, Adam said it, like this big unplanned experiment in remote working. I think, without wishing to bring the tone of the show down a little bit, I think of the vast majority in the world, the vast majority of people in the world are pretty lonely. And the pandemic was horrendous for that. They were stuck at home. Some people need that social setting of an office and things like that. And I was surprised, like many people were, when people would have like, you know, the Zoom pub and we'd all have like social events on Zoom, that you could actually generate a little bit more sense of presence and connectivity with people in a social setting than I think we expected. But it was nowhere near being in person with people. So to me, if I, as one person who works just by myself with people online most days, if I can feel like I'm sat in a room with them and I can really understand their body language, I can see their facial expressions, I can see and hear them clearly, even if what we're doing is just having a conversation, I actually think there's something really valuable about focusing on that. And look, we all talk shit about Mark Zuckerberg. I tweeted out about this yesterday. There's a really great, maybe you can link to this in the show notes, Stuart, when you put this out. There's a really great interview with Mark Zuckerberg on The Verge. And everyone makes fun of him being this awkward, you know, he's like, you know, everyone's like, the AI is finally reaching sentience when it comes to him. he actually speaks really thoughtfully and passionately about really focusing on building presence. And I think, in my mind, we should be able to feel present with other people online. And to me, that's in itself valuable. Putting aside all of the benefits of collaboration and all the fun stuff that you can do, I think that that is actually going to really help people around the world.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, I mean, people do give Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg a lot of crap. But, you know, typically those people are commentators, they're critics. And what the hell have they ever done? You know, frankly, he's doing something. And
he's having a go,
cannibalizing his own business potentially. So, you know, certainly all the Wall Street analysts who are saying, you know, it's time for Zuckerberg to go. I was like, you know what? What have you ever done? Trust someone who saw social media before it happened, or in its very, very early stages, if you remember Friends Reunited. So you started with a question of what was excited about the hardware, what was excited about the headset, and that, so I think there are a few things. The eye tracking is good. It's good that they've got that. I've not seen how the face tracking works, but being able to do foveated rendering, it makes a difference. That will reduce the processing load. So I'm not sure we picked up it's very computationally expensive to do that, because typically that reduces the graphic processing load.
Apparently, and I'm only quoting John Carmack here, it doesn't help that much. This particular iteration, at least, maybe it'll help in the future.
Yeah, that's where I heard it too.
But this particular iteration, let me see if I can find the actual quotation from him, just so I'm not misrepresenting him. But I can't find it. It's in my notes somewhere. Oh, yeah, he said, so Carmack says, it doesn't bring a massive performance boost with regard to the fixed foveated rendering, which Quest 2 did. So the impression I have is that it's a change from fixed to dynamic. And in theory, that may be a reduced processing load in the future. But at the moment, what you get back by only having to do high quality of the bit you're looking at is mostly counterbalanced by the fact that you have to put more effort into working out what it is you're looking at and adjusting to that in the first place.
So it sounds like he's talking about retrofitting it onto the Quest 2 then is more not computationally
quite.
It's more, intensive.
No. His pitch is that what the Quest 2 did was fixed. So it didn't track your eyes around and dynamically adjust the resolution of the bit you're looking at.
So if you are doing fixed foveated rendering, that basically means that it's the middle of the screen. Is high quality, and if you turn your eyes within your head, you will notice the fact that it's low quality on the outsides of the screen. The whole point on dynamic foveated rendering is you will never notice it because your eyes don't have high resolution on your peripheral.
It's like your peripheral vision, exactly.
It is. You also don't see color in your peripheral vision, which is a whole other story.
You don't. It's weird, isn't it?
And you could, and the optical nerve. There's a whole bunch of interesting things about you could cut out the optical nerve blind spot. Which people are completely unaware of, and you know, Saccades, and in fact, you're unaware of the fact that your
Saccades are brilliant. There's just a whole bunch of really interesting visual optical science.
It starts to get into like perception, and do we perceive reality as it actually is, or do we update a mental model of reality?
Before you guys go on down this optic love fest, what is Saccade kind
of
like?
Late night. Dope yeah. smoking at college sort of conversation about what is reality, man? Are we seeing it or what?
Well, what is, you mentioned something called Saccade. I don't know what that is. Listeners might know. What is that?
Saccade is your eyes are basically constantly moving. They're constantly darting back and forth. That is unless you are following something that's moving. The only time your eyes move smoothly is when you're looking at something that's moving through space. In normal operation, if you're looking at a field or a static field, your eyes are constantly darting around and it's updating your visual field. This is why you're not aware of the fact that you have low resolution and no color vision in your peripheral vision, because your eyes are constantly moving around and it's updating your mental model of what's going on in the world.
The beauty of this is that you can't tell, because if you look at yourself in a mirror and try to spot your eyes moving, you can't. First of all, because obviously when your eyes move, you're not looking at the mirror. But secondly, because your brain fills in all the bits in between, so you don't know it's doing it. It's essentially like, imagine you were trying to draw a picture on a wall with a laser beam. So it only points one point on the wall, right? But if you move the beam fast enough, it looks like a continuous thing.
Right.
Because it's moving that fast. Like if you see lights in a club or something, quite often they're not actually moving a light. They've got a tiny little mirror which moves around at ridiculous speeds and reflects a light all over the room.
Got it. Interesting.
This is not how saccades work, but it's sort of akin to that inside my head. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of really interesting optical science, which we're not going to talk about, but it is really interesting and you should read up on it.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the foveated rendering might not make much of a difference, because they certainly not relative to the fixed foveated rendering. What might make a difference is that you can't tell that it's foveated. Might be a difference.
And it's possible that future iterations of the tech, now they've taken the jump to, we've taken the computational hit by doing eye tracking and then refocusing and re-improving just that bit of the image. Once you've taken that hit and taken a step back because of it, from now on, that's your new baseline.
Yeah, so any exactly.
computational improvements you get from now on, get dynamic rendering for free.
If you start, then increasing the screen resolution to the point where it's human eye equivalent, then you know it might enable that to get there. And there are headsets out there that have human eye resolution screens. The Vario, which is a Finnish headset company, have a screen, and I've tried it. It's really quite amazing. But they're only able to do it in the center of the screen, and they didn't have dynamic foveated rendering.
So if you have that. I didn't know about this. If you have that human eye resolution, whatever that is, does that mean that, does it just look more real? Like, is that the kind of the impact of it?
You can't see the pixels, basically. That's and improving the screen resolution won't improve the quality of the image. You just won't
notice. So it just literally looks like you're looking out at a vista, essentially. It just looks completely clear, right?
It doesn't look pixelated in any way.
Right.
So like getting a better screen resolution on your phone.
Yeah.
Right. There's a point at which it doesn't improve the quality of your experience, because you can't tell the difference. And it is the same technology. It's just the only difference is you're holding the screen an inch away from your
eyes. An inch from your eyes. Yeah.
So if you did that with your phone screen, you'd be able to do that. So anyway, so the eye tracking is interesting partly because of that, then I think because it allows you to have some more authentic facial expressive and facial body language experience. So what we do right now is we pick up the microphone signal from the headsets. And we have an AI-powered facial animation rigging, which changes the shape of your mouth so that it mimics the shape of the words you're making, but then also picks up your intonation. So if I started thinking my eyebrows will be moving. We also have an algorithm that knows who you're looking at, and so we'll make eye contact with the person you're talking to, but then also break away. So you've got a more natural. If you constantly stare someone in the eyes, it's creepy. So there's a blinking algorithm and a looking away algorithm. So, you know, no one's going to win an Oscar right now for, you know, the fidelity of their facial rigging, but it is a sea change from having a blank face. So just having a face that moves at all makes a big difference. And then the amount...
So you've experienced this, right? You've experienced facial tracking in VR?
I have, not in a fully integrated... So yeah, they're not the first people to do facial tracking.
That's what I thought, yeah.
I have eye tracking and face tracking, and then been a whole bunch of add-ons. Right, so I mean, back in 2016 when I first got into this, you could get a Tobii eye tracking upgrade for the Vive headset. You could get a plug-in. No one ever bought it, and so that actually kind of leads on to why I'm. Well, I mean, the comfort issue with the headset might be important. I'm less excited about the mixed reality stuff because I'm not entirely sure what people are going to use it for. Main concern with this headset is the price, and that the price is such that even for enterprises, so the people I work with are not buying one or two headsets, right? They're buying 30 of them, 100 of them, 1,000 of them, and you start getting to those kind of volumes, a 4x difference in price starts making a really big difference.
Yeah.
I'm worried that the cost of it might be to the point where there aren't enough out in the field so that people aren't actually developing technologies, developing software that is going to take advantage of the hardware that's out there. So you end up with the same situation with all of the current devices that are out there with eye tracking. That there isn't good software that uses those features. Therefore, there's no point buying it, and you end up with a catch-22 situation where
you just don't get the adoption.
That,
right?
That was what was great about the Quest when it was $300. It was cheap enough that you could buy it without it being a huge investment. You could try it. You could buy it. Try it, see if you liked it. And so there are a lot out there. And for companies, it's the same way. You know, we can justify, if you can save one transatlantic business meeting for 20 people, that cost covers all of your costs for the headsets, for the software. And then from that point onwards, everything else is gravy.
Not 1,500 quid a pop.
But at the
300, and to be honest with you, I'm not that worried about the price at the moment. I mean, obviously the price is ridiculous and no one's going to buy them at this much money.
Yes, but the assumption, lots of people will buy them, sure, but not as many people will buy them.
Not enough people that it's actually useful, but the assumption is that this is basically a pre-release thing and the price should in theory come down in the future. The idea that something is too expensive right now, you go, okay, either no one buys it, the price never comes down and your industry goes away if that's what's required, or the price will come down over time.
And what's crazy is they're almost certainly...
This is not even for not buying it now. It's not...
Right. Yeah.
And they say they're not doing them at a loss. But we'll get on to that because it's a whole software question.
Originally, they were. They were 100% were with the Quest when it was $300 and it was earlier on. They were definitely selling them a loss. No question about it. Now, they increased the price and they've been building them for a while. So it's possible that they're not currently selling them.
Well,
what they've said on the new devices is that they will. This is an everything in one package device, and they will be releasing subsequent headsets quite soon that are a lower cost and have some of this technology.
Yeah, that was interesting from Carmack's talk, because when John Carmack was speaking, and his talk wasn't cleared with them before or whatever, and historically when he's done this kind of thing, he tends to not necessarily give out the stuff that the PR team might like him to. And one of the things he said was that he thought that... The assumption with a lot of the price points was that you'd be buying this, but then you'd also buy a bunch of software, for which Facebook, Meta, are currently claiming up to about 50% of all the money you're spending on software in the store. But if you get the headset and then just use the free social apps and don't buy any of the software, it's much like games consoles were, where they essentially do the console as a loss leader with the assumption that you'll then go and buy 15 games, all of which are $80, and they'll get $20 out of each of those purchases, and that subsidizes the purchase of the console in the first place. But with the headsets, Carmack's point, and he's walked it back a little bit because of essentially in-app payments. You know, the serpent has come to paradise once again. So even given the fact that he walked it back, one of the things he was saying was exactly that if Meta are expecting software purchases to subsidize the price of the headset and the kit in the first place, maybe that works for the enterprise model, because then the assumption is you'll be buying subscriptions to this, that, and the other. And, you know, they had Accenture on stage and all this kind of thing, but real people aren't.
Well, so... I know we've only got Adam for another 15 minutes. One thing I'd like to zone in on a little bit was something you just said, Adam, which is you were less convinced about mixed reality. One of the things I'd like to get both of your thoughts on this. So for those people who are unfamiliar with what mixed reality is, like I mentioned earlier on, it's basically where you see your actual room or your office or whatever, and then 3D items are overlaid on it, right? It's what... AR looks very similar on your phone, right? I personally think this is going to be where all of this is going to go. I'm less convinced about VR because I think people just, especially in a work setting, I think people feel weird having their actual, you know, your little spidey brain is always going to be knowing that your vision's blocked off, and it's unsettling. And I think a lot of people will feel a lot more comfortable spending longer periods of time beyond the 2-hour battery life in mixed reality. But what do you guys think, Adam? What makes you less convinced about it?
There's a couple of different definitions of mixed reality. There is the head-mounted augmented reality, where you are genuinely seeing the world, and then there is a transparent screen which is overlaying the, the world. And that, so that's like the Microsoft HoloLens, the Magic Leap, basically everything that's pretty much everything that's been released so far. Those look fantastic in demo videos. They're like, yeah, this is great. This is like the you know, the holographic characters in the movies, where you're like, someone appears in front of me. It's like the Star Wars hologram, or the Kingsman movie, where suddenly everyone's around the desk.
Yeah,
it's like, oh yeah, that's what I want. The reality is it is a grainy little screen, it like covering about 10% of your field of view, which if you angle your head correct, you can just about make something out about. The actual reality is not the same. It doesn't look like the demo videos at all.
So, before you go on there, yes, I absolutely agree that's what it is at the moment. First of all, I suspect we might be talking about it a bit differently when Apple comes out with whatever the hell they're coming out with. But more importantly, that to me seems like a technology limitation, much like a lot of the other stuff. When you were talking earlier about what we want to be able to do is hand things to one another and turn your attention and see the facial expressions and understand what's going on. There's quite a lot of equivocation between what we can actually do now and what the world looks like once all this stuff works. And the AR thing, I think it's reasonable to have the discussion in the same way, that the limitation with AR is not that at the moment the implementation is bobbins. It's that, do we want the thing at all? Imagine that it worked okay. Imagine that it worked as well as VR does now, or as well as the demo videos do. Would it then be okay, or is it still problematic?
I was going to kind of get to that, because what's interesting about Meta's approach to mixed reality is it's the second type of mixed reality, which is where you get a video feed. The headset records what's going on in the world as a video feed, puts that through, and then overlays virtual objects onto the video feed, not through a transparent screen. Yeah. So that, for me, that's going to be a lot more. That has a lot more potential. To actually work, and even
I agree.
And there's even a mixed reality where you are bringing in real objects into an entirely virtual world. So like a coffee cup, or a pen, or a keyboard, or a person. You know, and you are kind of bringing that into something that is rendered as a three-dimensional object. So the reason why I'm not skeptical. I think mixed reality has a lot of potential. I'm less excited about that right now because it doesn't give you the same sense of presence and immersion. Either the sense of presence of being in a place and actually feeling like you're somewhere else, or that you're, it's what we call co-presence or social presence, that you feel like you're there and there are other people there too.
Zoning in on that, like, are you saying that if, let's say, the three of us were in a mixed reality room environment, and I was sat here and you two were sat at the front of my desk, and we had all of the eye tracking and facial expressions turned on and all that kind of stuff, are you saying that you feel like that sense of presence wouldn't be as good as if we were sat in a virtual room?
That can't work. But think about it, just on a practical level, think about it, right? Sure. So if your idea is that the other two in this conversation are projected into the world of each of us, so Adam and I are sitting in front of your desk talking to you, right? In that situation, you and Adam will be sitting behind my monitor on the other side of the wall of my flat.
Right? Yeah, of course. It's going to be a different for each of us.
Well, but the point is that I think it's not possible, not for technical limitations, but for practical ones. You can't have someone projected into a place they're not in, but feel real there.
Well, that's my question. If you construct
a wholly unrealistic world that everybody is in,
right,
then you can make, because everyone's in the same world. You and I are not in the same place, and therefore the lighting's going to be wrong, and where you're sitting is going to be wrong and unrealistic. And
but that's my question is, like, do we think that's even feasible? Because I never really thought about your point, Adam, which is if you're in the virtual world, everyone's experiencing the same world from a different angle, right, based upon where you're sat. Whereas it doesn't really matter. Like, if I'm chatting to you two on a podcast, it doesn't really matter how you see me to me. It matters how I see you to you. But the question is whether you can develop presence with a avatar sat in the real world, or whether your brain's always going to be saying, that's not fucking real, you know?
But no, I think you can. I mean, and I run an experiment when I'm doing demos with people, which is pretty unpleasant for everyone, but I basically steer my avatar too close to them. I invade their personal space in virtual reality. And with like 99% confidence, people find that a very, very unpleasant experience. And that might be my personality. But you've tried out Glue, right? Jonna, did I insert myself on you then?
You did. Okay. You did that. And it was as unpleasant as just basically hanging out in the same room as you in a normal basis.
No, you're welcome. So for me, that's a pretty good indication of you know, getting that sense. And I think Stuart, you're onto exactly the right point. Say we're all sat around in an AR and a mixed reality experience. You would have to be static. You'd have to stay in the same place. If you got up and walked to to your desk to pick something up, chances are in someone else's room, you're going to be walking through their wall.
Walk
through a table. It would break that whole illusion of being
there. Yeah, you couldn't collaborate in that way. You couldn't interact in a physical way with the other avatars. It would only work if you are based.
Unless you've built a specific room which you then clone in multiple different places, which would be.
That's the tail not only wagging the dog but four other dogs. At that point, you say instead of building a virtual world, we'll design what a virtual world should look like, and then make you build it out of bricks and sit in it. What the hell is the point of that?
Absolutely.
But then again, I can see use case of if you're a company and you've got multiple offices all over the place, you've got meeting rooms. I can absolutely see that you model your meeting rooms in this mixed reality world. So you go to an office and you're sat there in a meeting room with two of your other colleagues, and the other people are sat in a similar kind of meeting room. If your meeting rooms are broadly, rectangles with a table in the middle.
Right, but now you're on the Oracle meeting wall, the huge screen. That's the whole concept.
Big screen.
I mean, to be clear, I think that's stupid, but I can see how that could potentially
work. And one, that's hugely expensive to do. Secondly, it's fixed. You know, you can't, if you're like, okay, you know what, actually, let's take this meeting outside. Let's go for a walk. Let's take it to a cafe. In the virtual world, you can, with a click of a button, you can be in an entirely different environment with a different feel and a different kind of ambiance to it. You can make it go from like, okay, now we're formal, we're staying on point, we've got whiteboards all over the place. Let's just take a sidebar and go to a coffee shop, just because. And it really doesn't matter. You know, I've seen firsthand that the environment you're in changes the way people behave.
It does,
and how they interact with each other. And so you can do that instantly in virtual reality. I'm gonna have to jump off in like the next 3 or 4 minutes.
So the flip side of all of this then, since we'll probably talk a bit more about the sort of larger philosophical aspects of it for a little bit, but the flip side of all this is what we're describing here about why mixed reality is maybe better than augmented reality and so on is, assuming I buy your point, important if what you want to do is model people having meetings. And I get, Adam, that's largely what the sort of stuff you're on. But there's a completely different sense where what you want to do is augment, things that are in the real world. What I want is when I walk past a shop, I can see what I bought from there last time or which of my friends have shopped there recently and so on. And that sort of thing is utterly useless. I do not want you to model literally everything I look at by taking pictures of it and then recreating it in bloody Unity, rather than just show me it and then put a little thing over the top of it.
I think that there's a place for. I mean, I always go back to the Minority Report, not the screens where they're holding their hands up and moving stuff around with their hands, which is a just horrible user interface.
It is.
But the walking past the shops and being blasted with individualized adverts, and I don't think anyone wants that. But frankly, we always end up with stuff we don't want. advertisers but want it.
I do want to, to speak the example you had earlier, you're talking about, you know, handing around an object in a room, but I'd be perfectly happy if I were seeing that object here on my disc in front of me and Jono would see it on his disc in front of him. I don't necessarily think that we need to be in a shared space to make that happen.
You do. Well, so I'm a mechanical engineer by training. In the world where you are looking at a complex physical object and pointing out points of it, being able to object that you're
no, that's fair. If you're gesturing it away, yes.
Here, and be able to mark
that I suspect all of these things will shake out. Look, I know we got to let you go, Adam. Thank you for coming on. It's actually nice to have people who know about this, because normally we're just three idiots who just guess. So,
well, I mean, I guess the bottom line is no one knows about this. The metaverse doesn't exist yet, other than in the mind, the imagination of a bunch of science fiction writers. And anyone speculating about what it or what it will be is making it up. So all we can do is kind of look at what people are doing right now and actually using it and start to maybe do some extrapolations from there. There's so many other areas we could dive into on the metaverse.
Yeah. All righty. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, Adam, for joining. We appreciate it. Go to our community. Let us know what you think. We got through point number one. We didn't even get through the avatars and all the other stuff.
I want to talk about privacy aspects of it. And
We can talk about that in the next show with Jeremy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We'll continue. You know, I'll tell you, getting Jeremy back will be a magnificent moment where we say to him, hey, Jeremy, guess what you could do? You could now look at the 90s CGI version of yourself and share Microsoft Teams with your teammates. Hooray, who wants that? Literally no one wants this.
As if people didn't hate Teams enough.
Well, I know. It's like, who wants Teams VR? But
you know
Adam,
you could host an episode of this in Glue, if you wanted to. We could get
that should be fun.
Record a video avatar version based of Glue. I do a lot of
that sounds fun. We should talk about that.
I think that would be a lot of fun, actually. Wicked.
Yeah. So, people in the community, let us know what whether we should do that, and say thank you very much to Adam. If people want to get hold of you, Adam, very briefly before you go, how should they do that? Or is the answer they shouldn't get hold of you and they should leave you alone?
You should leave me alone.
If you come near the house, I'll set the dogs on you.
Adam Lorimer. Look, there aren't that many Adam Lorimers in the world, so look me up on LinkedIn and send me a message. I usually accept people on that. If you want to know about Glue, go to our website, glue.work. You'll get through to, you'll be able to contact me through that way as well.
Cool.
Wicked. All right. Peace out, everyone.
Thank you very much.